said that if you want to give a talk at a conference, you either always ask to give a talk before a break, coffee break, lunch, or dinner. So, because you can always eat into that. But apparently I'm starting on time. Sorry about the technical difficulty. So Tillman always shows in his talks with this silhouette panoramic view of Stuttgart. So this is one of Cambridge, Mass, where you can see, of course, in the background, the skyline in Boston, and then the City Hall in Cambridge. This is the Massachusetts Hall. That's where the Harvard president does whatever he does. And this one is this building in the Strato building built by Frank Gehry at MIT, which of course has been a subject of a famous lawsuit because of the water leaks there. That's what people do at MIT computer science. You can Google it, Strato building. It's an impressive building, but it doesn't look like a building. So, but of course, this should not be confused with this Cambridge, which I won't tell you where it is, but I think you can you can guess. So I think most of you in the audience agree with me that this equation holds, but it only holds in one direction. Okay. I mean, Rydberg atoms really are now a powerful toolbox of atomic physics, atomic molecular and optical physics. And every day we sort of are amazed with the stuff, of course, mostly experimentalists can do with these things. But sometimes theory can also help. I'm sure all of you are aware of this book, which is essentially the Bible of Rydberg spectroscopy. I've been trying to sort of convince Tom to write a second edition, but he refuses to do so. So, there are plenty of programs in the world right now trying to sort of do quantum magnetism with Rydberg atoms. Okay, tomorrow I think there will be at least two talks about using Rydberg arrays in tweezers to do. Can you hear me in the back? I think you're okay. Okay, to do simulations of spin coupling, whether all of these different Heisenberg models, different Ising models, and so on. So here's one experiment just recently done in a group of Christian, Gross at Tübingen, where they tried to use these so-called programmable spin interactions in tweezers to simulate this XYZ Hamiltonian. The first term, of course, is the usual diagonal Ising model, and with applying a magnetic field. And then and these two other terms sort of represent this J plus plus. This one is this off-diagonal term, which is the so-called flop-flop. Flop-flop is when two spins together change direction. They flip or flop. And then this J plus minus is also off-diagonal, is this flip-flop. And this one example here, where two spins flip, but not the other one. So, and then there's also a simulation of this SSH Hamiltonian, the so-called SSH Hamiltonian, this staggered Hamiltonian, with in the group of Antoine Bonnevay in Paris. This is a number of years ago, where they were able to see these sort of edge states here, which are so-called topologically protected. Okay, so there are a great number of experiments, as I said. I mean, these are really a state-of-the-art experiment and calculations as well, where they can see, they can map these different phase diagrams across these phases. But what I'm going to mostly talk today is about the situation in all of these experiments. They live in this world, where you have essentially, whether you have atoms excited into Rydberg states, molecules and atoms interacting with each other. They're so far away, for instance, if they are in tweezers, that they only feed each other electrostatically. So you can use electrostatic interaction to describe how they behave, how they interact, for instance, van der Waals or dipole-dipole interactions. But once, I don't know why this guy is missing. Here there should be something like a dipole or an atom. This should be supposed to be a Rydberg atom, for instance. But once it goes inside, oh, now it is, okay. This is a PDF. Once it goes inside, that is to say, whether it's a molecule and another atom starts interacting within the orbit of the Rydberg atom, then it's not just these sort of electrostatic interaction. You really have to account for scattering, for instance, of the electrons in this case, and the ion as well, from this atom or molecule. So you would get both neutral and charge scattering, which occurs. So for instance, if you have a dipole, a molecule, okay, then the Rydberg electron would scatter from it. It could have, it's the so-called charge-dipole interaction, and it would have a form which is anisotropic, and it drops like 1 over r squared. R is the internuclear distance, and the small r is the Rydberg electron. But you can also have short-range interactions, which are of the type of electron scattering from a permanent dipole now. Electron scattering from an atom. Here is electron scattering from a permanent dipole. So here you can have electron scattering from an atom or an induced dipole, for instance, polarization, in which case it can be written in this sort of a Fermi pseudo-potential model of a scattering from a neutral particle, a scattering length. And by the way, how many of you know that in fact it was in fact in the realm of the Rydberg spectroscopy where Fermi introduced the scattering length in 1934. Not in nuclear physics, but in atomic physics. It was the first time that this whole idea of a scattering length was introduced. But these are the so-called short-range interactions. So I'm not going to go much into this because I know that Rosario later today will talk about these sort of like charge dipole and electron scattering calculations that one can do with Rydberg when Rydbergs interact with polar molecules. What I'm going to talk about is a spin-spin interaction, but of a somewhat of a different kind. Okay? As I said, any sort of a generic spin-spin interaction with this J-IJ coupling in alpha-beta, you can write down as a symmetric kind, where you get this JIJ alpha beta, JIJ beta alpha, or anti-symmetric kind, which is a difference between the two. Okay. The first one is what most of us are familiar with, Heisenberg, XXZ, and also this so-called RKKY, which is an indirect but a symmetric indirect interaction. That is to say, two spins interact by an intermediary spin. In what I'm going to mostly talk about is the spin of the Rydberg atom, like an effective spin. But there's also anti-symmetric, okay? And that is not, as far as I know, has not yet been introduced to AMO. It's this so-called Dereczynski-Moria interaction, which brings in chirality, spin textures. For instance, skirmions can be simulated using this type of interaction, okay? And it has been done in condensed matter, in solid state. So this is the one that what I'm mostly going to concentrate on. So we've done some preliminary work. When I say we, the people who did most of the work, Seth Rittenhouse, who's here, and Lina Kustenotsva, who's back in Russia, and it's collaboration with Susanna Yellen. So the idea was essentially you have a series of dipoles, bunch of dipoles aligned, let's say, and they can be molecules, they can be effective spins of Rydberg atoms in, let's say, lattices, or for that matter, you could sort of assume that you have even tweezers, although tweezers would be a little bit too far. And then you have a shallow well where you do Rydberg excitation. Okay. So the geometry would be that you have essentially a Rydberg atom, and then you have a molecule here separated by this distance, r. Okay. Now, as I said, this, in the first order, you can sort of describe the molecule is a dipole, and the Rydberg atom essentially can be represented as a charge. So it's a charge-dipole interaction, okay, which would be this, as I mentioned earlier. It's 1 over r squared. So what would this do? It is that it would try to sort of put a shift into the Rydberg energies, or for that matter, rotational energies of the molecule. So here's a diagram where you have a dipole as a perturber interacting with the Rydberg atom, in this case, rubidium in a 50s. And then as a function of distance, and this distance is measured in a fraction of microns, to let's say to a micron, you can see that for different rotational level, there is a shift in the Rydberg energies. And sometimes these shifts can be fairly significant in tens of megahertz. Okay. Of course, we're not operating in a regime because we don't want to sort of really create a very polarizable molecule. So this essentially is not 100% polarization. You want it to be in a sort of a quadratic regime where you can get a shift but not yet really polarize the molecule. Okay. With that, it's possible to write down this sort of a Hamiltonian, okay, which this term, this J-I-M represent the, one of the spins interacting with this intermediary spin, M, which would be like a Rydberg atom. You can simulate this so-called almost like a RKKY, sort of indirect spin-spin interaction. This is not a direct, the usual, let's say, Ising or Heisenberg interactions, but an indirect one. And just like the actual RKKY becomes, this coupling becomes sign periodic. It would change as a function of the spin-spin interaction, where the spins are aligned in the chain. Of course, it's not 100%. We're getting some sign periodicity, but of course here, the interaction between this and this and this, they still are negative. They don't quite oscillate, but they show some evidence of oscillation. And RKKY, of course, has been sort of used to sort of study things like frustration, random magnetization, and so on, because of this periodicity. The DMI, the other one, which is actually, so I should mention that this, of course, is SI dot SJ, whereas this is SI cross SJ, the DMI, this Dereczynski-Mario interaction, which brings in chirality into the motion. Okay. And that's where I'm going to concentrate the rest of my talk. So Eskermions, of course, is a sort of these elusive spin textures, which, as far as I know, have not been realized in cold atom physics, but I don't see it to be very long before they are interesting, and also because they're topologically protected. You cannot take an Eskermion, at least classically, texture like this and turn it into, let's say, a ferromagnet. Therefore, the spin texture is protected. So we've done some sort of basic exercises, and I will describe to you how this sort of can be implemented with Rydberg atoms. With taking a Hamiltonian like this, where this is the usual Heisenberg, and then you have this term, which is the DMI. This DMI coupling actually is a vector, okay, the vector coupling, plus this sigma I z. This is the work done mostly by Matteo Magoni, who was visiting ITAM as a student from Tübingen, and in fact that project is of his PhD is funded, as far as I know, by JIRAD, which is what this Rydberg network, which Kelman runs. So the things I'm going to show you are these sort of DMI interactions with a DX along the X direction, and another one with a DZ. Okay? So this DMI vector pointing along the magnetic field. So this is the DX interaction. So your spin, or the spins, are sigma y, sigma z in this yz plane, of course, which produce a vector perpendicular, which is in the x direction. And the magnetic field is along z. So when, and everything is normalized to j equal to 1, the usual Heisenberg interaction equal to 1. When dx over j is equal to 2, just twice as large, let's say, in this case is more than twice, almost three times as large. So when it is this, at, if you wish, a small magnetic fields, the system sort of the spins. In this case, this is for 8 spins. Okay, we've done it for several different spin chains, but I'm showing you a typical example. We'll see that domain balls form. Okay, and in this case, in this range, there are 2 domain balls. One is here with 5 spins, and then 3 spins down. And of course, because it's a periodic boundary condition, there is another wall here. And the same also in this region. But of course, the spin texture is different because we're looking at the magnetization in the ground state, and of course, is not fully aligned like the way I have shown. This is the one component of the spin vector which has the highest probability. And then in the region when the magnetic field becomes large, significant, as you would expect, all of the spins are polarized because the D term really is no longer sufficient to sort of drive the transitions. However, when D is now reasonably large, what does that mean? It means that in this region, D is significant because H is smaller. And D. Okay. So the DMI term is significant here, and that is to say this term dominates over these terms. Then you form 4 domain balls. So the spins, the 8 spins, would tend to align themselves like this. Again, this is one which has the highest probability component of the full wave function. So there are 4 domain balls. And then when D and H, or the magnetic field, become comparable, then a 2 domain ball structure forms with 6 spins, domain ball here and a domain ball there in this region. And when the magnetic field becomes dominant, this term dominates, then you get a fully polarized state. So you're beginning to sort of see with this D how you can drive sort of, magnetic domains that form in this case a one-dimensional chain, but it can also be done, I suppose, in 2D. Now, when D is pointing along the Z direction, along the magnetic field, the spins are interacting in the XY plane, and then with a perpendicular S1 cross S2, which is along Z. Then a measure of chirality of the motion. And so everything I've described sort of shows you how the domain balls form. But I haven't told you anything about chirality because the whole idea was this S1 cross S2 was to show the chirality of the spin. Let's say, think of it not quite as a helical motion, but a chiral interaction. And this now becomes evident here. So a measure of chirality would be this term, this constant, or number, if you wish, Q. Sigma I dot sigma j cross sigma k, okay? Which is plotted here. Now, when a small magnetic field, by the way, this dz over j is now still 2.7. It's not written down here. At a small magnetic fields, okay, where the d term is dominant, the chirality actually, counterintuitively, when you think about it, is still zero. And the reason becomes evident when I describe when D and H, a magnetic field, become roughly comparable to another. So when, in this region, when the D, this term, and this term are roughly comparable, you begin to see a chirality, this is normalized, which is not zero of the spins. So, and the way to interpret it, at least the way that I can do it right now, is that the spins, so what D does, this DMI interactions, is like shuffles the deck for the spins. So if the spins which are in the XY directions, in the XY plane, sort of get redistributed, okay? They're not either like this, sticks like that. They get redistributed. And now, when the magnetic field, because comparable, it tries to lift these spins up. Of course, the degree at which it sort of lifts the spins gives the actual spin wave function a sort of a chirality, chiral behavior. Imagine you put the spins into different orientations, and then you try to lift them in the z direction. And they sort of lift at different rate. They're not being lifted at the same plane, right? Because they have different directions. And therefore, you form a sort of a texture. And that's when chirality is not zero. And then it goes back to zero when this becomes very dominant. Of course, everything lifts, becomes polarized. You could, if you look at the magnetization, this is, the label is missing. This is, again, the same as the other one, sigma z in the ground state, magnetization, the usual magnetization degree. It sort of shows this stairwells. Okay? It's zero when this term is dominant. And then it sort of grows and then becomes fully polarized, okay? Which is exactly the same as one would observe in an XY Hamiltonian, XY, with this magnetic field. However, if for a usual XY Hamiltonian, if you calculate this Q, this chirality, will always be zero. It will not be like this. It is this DMI term that gives this this chiral behavior. Now, how do we turn this into a picture which can be used for Rydberg spectroscopy? I'll show you two examples, okay? And one of which is based on this Friedel virtual bound state. For those of you who are familiar with the Fano configuration interaction, actually Friedel, when he wrote this paper, he does not refer to the Fano's configuration interaction paper, which was, I think, was like 1939. But in fact, it's very similar. The whole idea is that you have a bunch of, in the language of condensed matter, you have magnetic spins, magnetic sites here. And then you have a non-magnetic impurity. Okay? For the examples I'm going to sort of, in the picture you're going to have, a mental picture would be a Rydberg electron excited into an orbital. In this case, let's say, an L equal to 2 orbital. In fact, the virtual bound state model is an electron which is in the L equal to 2. And then interacts with all of the conduction electrons. And that interaction with these bound states in the continuum will give rise to a broadened peaks, okay, which are the what we know happens also exactly in the Fano configuration interaction picture. So the picture of a Rydberg atom would then be something like this. You get a d orbital, and you have spins, okay, other atoms, let's say, or molecules, in these lobes, different lobes, at different positions. They can be arbitrarily, of course, rearranged themselves. Okay? And this angle, of course, comes about from this spin-orbit interaction. So you have the first two terms, gamma prime with this delta function, representing the spin of the electron of the Rydberg atom interacting with these two spins, S1 and S2. And then there's a spin-orbit interaction, which brings in anisotropy. So in the picture, the Friedel-Virchow bound picture, you write the wave function as essentially a plane wave, all of your conduction electrons, plus and phase shift for L equal to 2 electron. And this is the dipole, interaction Hamilton matrix element divided by, effectively, the width of the resonance times this spherical harmonics in L equal to 2. And now, and this has been done by Smith and Frith a while ago. And if you go into essentially a third order perturbation, you can calculate all of these matrix elements, essentially, and then integrate over all of the momentum representations of the conduction electrons. And at the end, you get a form which looks like this, R1 dot R2, where R1 and R2 are these two guys, R1 and R2, times R1 cross R2, times dot with S1 cross S2. This whole thing is what the DMI interaction is. So the DMI interaction in Rydberg, if you do excitation, would involve cross of the, essentially, the position of the two atoms, or the two perturbers, if you wish. And then you can go ahead and calculate it. And another way that you could think of it is this thing that we're doing with Lina and Seth and Suzanne, is assuming that you have number of effective spins. It can be Rydberg atoms, it can be polar molecules, okay, each of which is represented by an effective spin, S1, S2, and Si, Sj's. And then you have an intermediate or mediator spin, which would be a Rydberg atom, but one which actually moves. So it's a mobile Rydberg atom. Just as, for instance, these measurements of the Rydberg polarons, the Rydberg atom is actually a mobile impurity. So, and this mobility is what allows for the formation or construction, if you wish, and I'll show you how, of this DMI S1 cross S2 interaction. So they move with some momentum K naught, of course, initially, and then they couple to all of the different momenta, K. So the matrix element, so this would be effectively the picture. You start with the ground state with some momentum K naught, okay? You have spin up and down, ij, and then you couple to a Rydberg state, and then this coupling brings you back to a ground state, but of course the ground state, the spins are now flipped. And the cost in energy is delta E, which is written here. Of course, for this to really be in the perturbative regime, this dipole-dipole interaction should be, or charge-dipole interaction, if you wish, should be much less than this energy splitting. And when you do that, I want to go here first. So your matrix element essentially would be this, right? You go from the ground state, this coupling to a momentum with excited state, E, K, and then back down to this, okay, over delta E. So it's essentially second order perturbation. Okay. Now, if you make a certain assumptions, and this is just to sort of motivate the argument, you can write this interaction essentially as a sum over this script V times the spins, okay? Spins of the sites, of the dipoles, if you wish, and the mediator spin. And if you integrate over the momentum, then this becomes V times e to the I delta k. Well, delta k is the difference between the different momenta, ki minus k. And now the whole effective interaction would become ai plus minus si plus sj minus. We're now back to usual Heisenberg interaction, except that it is not, because j is now complex, okay? Because of this. It's complex, and then when it's written down fully, this J perp would have a real part, two real times Jij plus minus, and then an imaginary part, which is this. This is the DMI interaction. Okay? So the real part would reproduce the symmetric interaction, and the imaginary part would give you this antisymmetric, this chiral interaction, okay, which is what is necessary, just like here, to sort of simulate all of these indirect chiral interactions, which is what we are doing. So I don't know. I think I'm going to end. Am I doing on time? OK. So in what we are sort of now can do is that we can simulate a variety of indirect, including chiral, spin interactions with Rydberg atoms. But besides that, as far as I know, there has never been an attempt to actually, from first principles, calculate the RKKY and DMI couplings. And I think we have now the prescription to be able to do that. And of course, not analytically, but we can calculate it in a closed form. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Yeah, so I have a few technical questions. So just to make sure, like your last comment, so assume you work in the van der Waal regime and you realize this anisotropic Heisenberg interaction. So is that correct that if you could engineer J to be complex, then it's a sufficient condition to get this anti-symmetric?
Yeah, there would have to be a sort of a symmetry breaking, yes, but it's also possible.
I see. So
we didn't do it.
And is the idea is that we do not know of such symmetry breaking mapping? That so if we wanted to do, so given existing platforms of van der Waal type interaction, either using perturbative approach or Floquet, do we know of any such ways of realizing that Hamiltonian?
I have not seen one yet in the context of ultra cold, atomic collisions. And honestly, I haven't given it much thought because we were sort of more interested in this Rydberg perturber interactions. I have not seen it.
Yeah. So the reason I ask, because those tweezer platform, they realize a spin lattice model. So understand with those state dependent lattices, you could realize, but it would require significant rebuild. But there's ways of engineering those complex J. It just require a site selective addressing. Okay. And this cool. Have been studied in perfect transport in spin networks, where the study of symmetry breaking can be studied. So, but more generally, if you could simulate this class of anti-symmetric Hamiltonian, is that equivalent to simulating fermions on lattices? So like one general problem of given this anisotropic Heisenberg is mapping to fermions, which is somewhat the billion-dollar problem to be solved.
No, that's a good point. I don't know.
So do we know if there's an equivalent class of Hamiltonian?
I do not know, but it doesn't mean that.
But if it I think that would be very powerful, because then then it it relates to condensed matter applications and also chemistry.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I have a question that is probably more on the boson side of this. Has to do with the Holstein-Primakov transformation and the eventual possibility of observing spin superradiance in this kind of system. Have you ever thought about this? So by tuning these parameters, you can have some phase where you have this macroscopic occupation of some ground state. Have you ever looked in your Hamiltonians that you see if it's
No, we have not. Okay. No, but I mean, it's a, so I don't know much about the spin superradiance, but yeah, I mean, we have not.
So probably we can discuss after.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. No, that's...
Thanks. So it's a lot of really interesting physics we could try to realize. I just wanted to get the scale for some of these couplings. Like at the beginning, you were saying you've got sort of megahertz shifts, but it looks like the dipole has to be very close to the Rydberg atom. Could you maybe just comment a bit on how close they have to be to make these sort of tens of kilohertz scale couplings at the end?
So for these types of interactions, the what I was describing, with the dipole would have to be, let's say, close within to of the Rydberg orbit, to get these types of shifts. But if you can do away with smaller shifts, of course, you can be much farther away.
So when you get your couplings at the when you get the couplings for the spin models at the end, though, are they assuming that you have these sort of megahertz scale shifts? Like, are you assuming that these are the kind of spacings?
Here, of course, they were constant. They did not depend on distance, and here, we have to calculate them, so to know exactly how large or how small they are with distance. But I would say that if we're still going to concentrate on perturber within or impurity within the distance of the Rydberg atom, then the sort of couplings that we sort of estimated would still hold.
All right, well,
thank you.